Welcome back to the Restoring Darkness podcast. On today's show, I'm pleased and honored to be joined by Yash Sondhi. Yash is a postdoctoral researcher working in the Kawahara Lab in the Florida Museum of Natural History. He obtained his PhD at Florida International University in Miami with Dr. Jamie Theobald, studying how moths and butterflies see the world, and specifically how moth eyes and brains adapted to function so well under dim light. He uses multiple techniques, genetics, animal behavior, neuroscience, to examine how different day and night flying insects' senses, sight, hearing, smell, have evolved. As human civilizations develops, artificial light is slowly eroding dark skies with disastrous consequences for animals, plants, and humans. And I think Mark Baker would say, not so slowly. As awareness increases that light pollution is harmful, or in fact is pollution, understanding how different mitigation strategies work is crucial to implement change. Yash is thus studying how light can disorient and alter the circadian activity of insects, and testing strategies to mitigate light pollution. He also contributes to community science and insect biodiversity monitoring in India and Central America. He is on X at @mothyash, Instagram, @nocturne_mariposa. All will be posted on the restoringdarkness.com website. But before we get to him, I got to tell you a little bit quickly about the Lighting and Darkness Foundation, who produces this show. Lighting and Darkness Foundation is the lighting industry. That's right. It was created by lighting professionals specifically to address night preservation and darkness restoration. And we find ourselves here on the Restoring Darkness podcast doing the work of the foundation. We are also creating educational programs, and we are helping mitigate light trespass disputes in the field. We are going to begin our campaign of education as soon as you start donating to this damn show, folks. So go to restoringdarkness.com, click the donate link. Why not become a monthly donor? Why not support the foundation, especially you lighting folks out there? So we're working on an educational program. We got a bunch of stuff we're doing if you want to support this work, especially if you're in the lighting industry, and become the lighting and darkness industry with us. That's right. We're leaving half of it out, leaving half the cycle out. And before we get to the interview with Yash, we want to talk about softlights.org, Mark Baker's foundation, who joins me here as the podcast co-host. And Mark's work there he's doing incredible work. So just go to softlights.org. I think his big thing right now has to be his petition to the FDA to reduce the glare from headlights. Mark, maybe you can talk about that in the closing of the show. Yash, welcome to the Restoring Darkness podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Moths, you know, who cares about moths? That's the problem we face, right? And when we're talking about this, it's hard to convince human beings, hey, the birds can fly over there. You know, why do they have to fly over here? It's where humans are. How do we create a science and a movement that embraces other living beings in the world, not just humans?
So, yeah, that's a question that all of us studying animals and to some extent conservation grapple with. But I think one important thing to remember, as we've been seeing with climate change and sort of global destruction, is that we live in an ecosystem that's full of balance. And as that balance gets tipped in one direction or the other, it has huge consequences on our own health, our well-being. So thinking about moths as this insect that lives in a jungle that has nothing to do with us isn't reality. Reality is that we get mosquitoes, we get moths in cities, in urban areas, and we just don't see them as often because when it's a light out, they don't like that much light. But they are still trying to pollinate your gardens. If you put, say, moth pollinator flowers in your garden, they will come and increase the fruit, increase the flower. So they are interacting with us, just we sort of choose to ignore it. And I think one of my favorite examples is we did a native plant sale in Florida where we gave people night blooming flowers. And we literally had people fighting over it to plant it in their garden. So I think a lot of us sometimes forget that a lot of insects live in your own backyard. And thinking of that as a means of making change is a better way than saying it's happening in some forest a million miles away.
The what's interesting, the only time people talk about lighting in moths is when they want to kill them with light. right? So people use insect lights to kill insects, outdoors, indoors, all that kind of stuff. But what you're talking about in your research is how electric outdoor light at night impacts these species and how that is a negative impact for the entire biodiverse area around them, perhaps the entire world. Describe a little bit, how does electric light at night damage insect behavior and why is that important to humans?
Yeah. So what we've been seeing with some of our recent work and other groups who've been studying this is that light, insects have evolved for the last 350 million years without any artificial light. They had the sun, they had the moon, they had the stars. And their senses, their flight, their vision is sort of adapted to function in those environments. Now, they use this, it's sky to navigate, sort of fly in a straight line. Now, when we put these bright lights, what multiple things happen. The first thing that happens is it confuses the sense of navigation and flight stability. So these insects that are flying through the night sky looking for food, looking for mates, they sort of, as they approach lights, they get confused and they think the light is the new sky, and that causes them to sort of tilt and start steering and around the light, and that causes them to sort of get stuck there. They get trapped. So lights, artificial lights, especially when they're pointed upwards or sideways, that they can confuse the insect and sort of think of like a big sticky trap, but that's light. So the same reason why insect light traps work to kill insects, which you have an electric zapper. But what the light does there is sort of draw the insects towards it. And that's one of the big things that happens across lights in forests, in your garden, which is that the light acts like an attrapment mechanism and sort of just sucks insects in to the region that it's being lit. And that then prevents them. What then happens is a lot of night flying insects, especially, they, after say about 20 minutes to exposure to light, they're like, oh, it's daytime. And then you just sit there the whole night. And next morning, they're easy prey for birds, for bats, and they just haven't mated, haven't laid eggs. So it sort of disrupts them in multiple ways.
And so when we're looking at, you know, when we're thinking about moths or mosquitoes or something, we're talking generally about human pests is how humans would see these creatures. And so they're flying around. What is the difference from your perspective between starlight, moonlight, and electric light? Now, why is it that electric light is so impactful? And can we have, I guess I'm going to bookend that question with, can we have electric light that doesn't hurt the insects?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And I think there are people who are trying to do that. We can have light that illuminates our streets that doesn't harm insects by doing two things. A, by having the light only when we need it. So by turning it, say, using motion sensor lights. So that's one way, which is we don't go out all the time, but when we do, we want light. So have things that turn off and on based on when humans are there. And the second thing that we've shown, and many other people are starting to see now, is that light, the direction of light is really important. So oftentimes we put out a big street light and it goes and lights upwards, lights sideways, but we're only usually trying to look at the ground. We're trying to look at a small area. So by shielding these lights and by sort of adding fixtures that direct the light to a much narrower area, you can effectively reduce the impact on both astronomy, the night sky, and other insects. So you can sort of say, look, we need light, but we don't need it in all directions. So we can still have it, but reduce the area in which it spreads.
Yeah, so it's about intelligent lighting, which we don't seem to have right now. Yash, I want to first tell you that my father was an entomologist.
Oh, wow.
He's passed away, but he would be absolutely thrilled that I'm talking to you and doing this. It would just be so exciting for him. So that's exciting for me. And so I want to tell you a little story. So when I was growing up, we would go camping and we would pack the car with all the camping gear. But something unusual in our family is we'd pack a white sheet. And so when we got to the campground, my dad would hang up this white sheet between two trees, and then we'd turn on a Coleman lantern and all these insects would show up. And for me, that was just, that's part of camping. But now I've realized, well, not everybody does that. That was just my dad. So I have some technical questions for you after having read your study, and it's just amazing, right? You've discovered something just truly unique. So my dad would hang this white sheet vertically, and then the moths would become, and we'd watch them flit around. But in your report, you talk about where the light should be, and then you could lay this white sheet horizontally. What would be the difference to the moth? This and that, now we're talking about reflected light. What would be the difference to the moth if it saw this reflected light this way versus horizontally on the
Yes,
ground?
that's a great question. I think as you said that moth trapping is something that anyone who's an entomologist has done for a long time, and they sort of let other people do it. But you're right, a very common theme is sort of hanging the light horizontally, not vertically. And whereas in our experiment, since our goal was to show this very extreme impact of inverting when you have light come reflected light coming from below. We sort of place it under. Honestly, I think what we'd find is something similar to what you get with a bulb, where if for ex the way I look at it, a reflected sheet is sort of still giving them direction of light. So now it's like there's the sky is to the right of them, and they flip, and they'll sort of probably try and fly into the sheet, because that's like as they flip around pointing to the sheet, they start automatically start banking, and then as they bank, they'll just sort of fly into the sheet. And then once they hit the sheet, they sort of get confused, and then they just probably sit there because now their eyes are blinded. And that's probably why you get all these insects sitting at the sheet, is that they're flying, they turn, and they start like sort of flying into the sheet, and once they hit it, it becomes like a barrier. It's why a lot of entomologists also use light traps with sort of three blockers, so that when the insect flies and sort of hits the sheet, the blocker, it sort of gets disrupted and falls into the trap. So I think a lot of these, yeah.
Wow. So I think you brought up two ways that the moth is navigating. So in your study, and for those listeners who hadn't seen your study, you've discovered that the insects turn their backs towards where this light is coming from, which in the old days would have been the stars or the moon, right? And so this th that they're not using necessarily their eyes for this navigation, it's they're turning their backs. But now you're saying that, but they're also got eyes. So they if they see this light, first their backs are to it and they're trying to orient themselves to this light, but if they get close enough, now they can't see. Just like humans, they're blinded by the glare and now they don't know what to do. It's just overwhelming their senses. Is that right?
Yeah, so sort of the two ways to think about it are they still see the sky with their eyes. They have some animals have different they have simpler eyes along with the big compound eyes. So different animals sort of look at the sky through different pairs of eyes. They call ocelli. But in most moths, they exist, but most of the time they can use their big eyes to look at that. So they're getting sort of two inputs. They're getting a view of the world. And they're getting this. Imagine you just had a really small. You've now your smartphones have like multiple cameras. So imagine you had another camera that all it did was image a very blurry image of what's above you, and that's sort of what we think these ocelli are doing. They're giving them a very quick way to say what's bright versus what's dark. So they have two different sort of modes of sensing. One is their compound eyes, and one is this like ocelli, and different insects do it in different ways, but what we think is happening is that as they're flying, the ocelli or these like think of them as just simple discs that are telling you what's bright. That's telling them where the sky is, and if you're flying, you want to be oriented. You want to know where the sky is. So they're flying. They think the sky is up, and they're flying and doing their entire flight. Now, at some point when they start approaching the light source, and it's like the moon, right? They know a moon is high in the sky, but it's not overwhelmingly brighter than the rest of the sky if you average it. But now when they reach this light source, it suddenly looks like at some point their brain starts telling them the sky is to the right of me or to underneath me. And then they flip and they try and point their backs or they try and fly in this direction because they're like, oh, our sky is here. We got tilted, of course, and now the sky is here. So they're still flying forward, but they're sort of trying to reorient with respect to gravity. And what happens now is gravity is pulling them downwards, and even they're trying to fight gravity to the side. So there's nothing here, and they're trying to push against it, so they tilt. So a lot of the tilting is happening because they're fighting gravity that's no longer there. And then gravity is actually pulling them down, which they're no longer fighting. So they get this mismatch of forces, and that's what causes the sort of the flight paths to change. And then what happens is as they reach the light, their circadian clocks kick in, because a lot of our circadian clocks are driven by light. You know, when you get jet lag, the easiest way to recover from it is to be in a lighted environment and not keep the curtains closed, because light entrains our biological clocks. So light can sort of override a lot of whether you sleep, whether you wake. So when these moths hit this really bright area, in about 20 minutes, their eyes, two things happen. Their eyes adapt the same way our eyes adapt when we go outside. And at some point, their brains start telling them it's daytime. Just sit and relax, because you're nocturnal. You're in the wrong circadian rhythm. So like three things happen. They get disoriented. They change their flight. Their eyes change and they become, sorry, they close a lot because there's too much light. And then after, say, half an hour, their brains just sort of tell them it's daytime. So now if you turn the light off, this is the interesting idea. In about half an hour, they all take off and they fly away, because they're like, oh, it's night again, and their eyes are back to normal. So it's this idea that light's sort of keeping them there even once it traps them because of the other aspects of their biology.
This electric light is sort of overwhelming their circadian rhythm. It's so intense compared to starlight and moonlight that it overwhelms their senses and tells them it's basically noon sky. Relax and stay here so you stay out of the line of predators. What I've seen from other scientific papers and that is that they can actually watch evolution happen over generations of fruit flies or whatever. Have you noticed that some moths are succeeding with the light pollution at the expense of other moths?
So that's a great question. I haven't seen any studies that have shown moth species that are actually doing better at night or with light. I have seen anecdotal reports of some pest species that are, say, mosquito pests, increasing how long they're active in winter as light periods increase. And there are also links to things like photoperiodism. So like when you eclose or when you diapause. So a lot of insects, as winter comes, they go into this diapause, this state of like hibernation, and they emerge again. And it seems like light pollution can change these cycles and affect pest species and make them come earlier or later. But I've not heard of any stories where sort of some species are being positively affected. We have some data that suggests some are less affected than others. So we'd expect over competitive times, they'd do better. But I don't think anyone's actually gone and measured that in the field.
There was a study for birds that did show that urban birds, their eyes, pupil size is shrinking. So it wouldn't be a surprise that the same thing was happening with the moths.
Yeah. So yeah, there's actually a study that's just about to come out, or it's come out and I haven't seen the full data, but showed the same thing, that in species that were evolving in light polluted areas, their eyes have shrunk over generations.
And so there is evolution. Yeah. We're seeing evolution,
there is evolution.
Happen.
We're seeing evolution. It's hard to measure in the wild, but there's one guy in Sweden, in Switzerland, Florian Altomet, he showed that these moths in highlight polluted areas are just active less over multiple generations, and their eyes change in size. A few other people who looked at it with museum collections didn't find it. So it's one of those things where we know it's happening, but finding or proving conclusively that it's happening in any one example is sometimes harder because it just takes a lot of generations to look at these things.
Mm-hmm. But like nocturnal animals are much more visibly impacted by electric light pollution than diurnal animals would be, is basically what we're saying. And so you can see that, you know, a nocturnal animal with a small 60-watt LED light outside of your house that's unshielded can be massively infected, causing its own death or destruction of its life. And not that I don't care about a particular moth that much, whether a moth dies or lives is not relevant. But what we're saying is that, you know, we're seeing the impacts of light pollution at a far more, like, if humans were being hurt like this by some sort of process of environmental change, human created environmental change, people would be aware of it immediately. But because we're not nocturnal, the light pollution is not as impactful upon us as on our own circadian rhythms, because we can hide from it. We have curtains. We have different methods of getting away from it. But these nocturnal species are very troubled by this light pollution and can't get away from it.
Yeah, that's accurate.
Hmm. Wow.
Yash, as an advocate, I try to, just like Michael, excuse me, we're trying to say, well, what should we do with our lighting in the cities? Now, in your study, you talked about the difference between point source, what you called a point source, and a diffuse source. Now, I've often advocated for these bollard-style lights, which is about 1 meter tall, and they've got these louvers on it to keep the light close to the ground. But I got a little confused because in your report about this sort of, if this sheet thing was sort of on the ground and now this light is reflecting up, that the moth is going to be confused because now it's sort of upside down, right? So the light is coming from up. And I think if I understood your report, that's not the right thing to do. So I'm a little bit lost now. Should we be advocating for a tall pole that, is above and so illuminates down like this? Or should we sort of advocate for reflected light? I don't know. Do you understand what I'm saying? Can you help me out here?
I mean, so I think what we found is that it's only when you have a really reflective or a white surface on the ground that a downward pointing light has an issue. So like in Costa Rica, the field site has, as you said, these low lights that are like pointed on the ground, on the grass. And that's fine because the grass is just absorbing most of that light and it's not reflecting grass. It back out. So if you had it on a tarmac and that was really bright and reflective, then that would be bad. But it's still better than a light because the amount of the intensity going out, for us to do that, we had to have a really bright light and a really large white sheet. But I assume if you have a small light that's close to the ground, your area of capture is still about a foot around the light, even if it's reflective, compared to if you had the light upwards, you'd have just a much broader sphere in which you could get insects. So,
That brings up another question. And in your report, you talked about that you didn't really study color temperature. How do you know then in your studies that this, what's going on, is not related to blue light, let's say, versus amber? We promote amber as something better. We've seen studies that show that the blue light appears to be even worse for the insects. They come and they circle and they die, like 50% death when you have these bright blue lights.
So if birds, you're talking about birds, they're not insects, right?
No, I'm talking about insects.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, they come and they're super attracted to this blue-white light. They circle. But we didn't know. That was like just last year. We didn't know that it's because they were turning their backs. This is something new that Yash has figured out, right? But now how do you separate out? How do you know that your discovery is correct and it's not – like if you didn't do amber light, how do you know that that was something?
So that's a great question. It's sort of one of those, you're in the field, we had a bunch of lights, but we were like getting the best results with UV lights. And we were like, oh, let's maximize this because we have limited time. Mm. But it's something that, so we did actually try white lights. We didn't really put all the data, but we got the same effect. So UV had the strongest effect in the sense the effect would be the same whichever color we use, whether we use white or UV, but we just get more insects in an hour with UV. So our guess is that it's still happening with white light. It's just that it's not as strong a response because it takes more. The way you look at insect photoreceptors is they have UV blue and green, and UV and blue is sort of exciting this phenomena that is pretty much like the night sky. Whereas if you have white light, it's only 1/3 of that is blue. So now you're getting a weaker response. And we assume if you use amber light, you're not mimicking anything like the sky. So yes, it's going to affect insects like fireflies that use yellow colors for mating, but it's not going to mimic the sort of downward light of the sky, especially in the blue spectrum. So I think there are a lot of other studies where people have looked at how different colors affect them and it cause attraction. So we didn't want to redo that. But there are lots of studies where people show that they're predominantly attracted to UV light and less to amber or red light. So we sort of assume that'll hold in our case as well. But yeah, we don't. I think a lot of that's going to depend on the insect species in question and what their visual system sees.
Oh my gosh. Yash, you're telling me, like, you just mentioned something about fireflies. Okay. We've got humans, we've got fireflies, we've got moths, we've got birds, we've got turtles, we've got snakes. Like, everybody's got these different spectra that they're adapted to. Bats, I think, will, have something else going on. Like, does your mind explode because there's no perfect solution? We're going to have to injure some species or something? Or is there sort of a, you said earlier, is there a medium, happy medium for everything with this?
So I think it's surprising, but one of the things that we've looked at and what people have been starting to see in practical studies is it's why I think we need to test mitigation measures and see empirically what works. Because we're not, if we go from theory and look at one insect, you're not going to be able to find the best way. But like there was a study in Germany that I reviewed where they did this. They looked at shielding and they put on these like traps on these shielded lights versus unshielded lights. They tried different light colors, they tried different things, and they saw which one caught the least insects. And they found that changing color or reducing brightness was much, it was useful, but it reduced the trap about like change, reducing the direction of light had about 10 times more impact. So I think that's what people have been seeing, which is that theoretically, we can think of color, we can think of brightness, we can think of all these things, but when you go out to the field, it turns out some mitigation measures are just much better than others in terms of how much they affect, say, just insect trap is one example, right? And I assume the same thing could work for birds and turtles. So I'd assume my guess is that we just actually have to go out and test them, and that data is not actually that hard to get because now you have automated techniques. It's easier to get that data now than 10 years ago.
Michael, I think that's a great idea. This idea that we need to go in and experiment and test a theory. I see a lot of stuff where there's just theories, and we
Oh,
talk
you
about
mean like we should deploy the scientific method to solve our problems?
it. Yeah, maybe test some of these theories because there's a lot of talk out there about what could work.
You know,
But is there?
I'm going to interrupt you because what I've been saying after almost is this 100th episode of Restoring Darkness, Scott? It's got to be close. One of these ones, so almost there. Maybe this is 99. Maybe this is 100. I don't know. But after 100 episodes and being in the lighting industry for 25 years, this is what I'm going to say, Yash. The lighting industry does not know how to safely and effectively illuminate the outdoor environment at night. End of the story. Like, there's no, I don't care what the IES says. I don't care about what the IDA says. I mean, you have to remember the IDA has changed their Kelvin. First of all, they shouldn't be using Kelvin temperature. Okay, that's the wrong metric. But they've changed it from 3,000 to 27 to 22 to 1,800 in the last 3 or 4 years. I mean, last 3 or 4 years. Like, this is people stumbling around, excuse the thing, in the dark. You know what I mean? Just like grabbing at the latest idea and putting it out there. And I think the lighting industry has to start funding this kind of research, to step back and say, you know what, enough with this committees and volunteer committees of people that sell light fixtures. That's what the IES is. They're volunteer committees of people that sell light fixtures. They create standards. They're not scientists, Yash. And it's time for them to step back and say, you know what, maybe we need to do a study on the right spectral illumination for nocturnal wildlife, including insects, wolves, bats. What is the best color temperature quotations, right? What is it? What is the best nanometers of light that we should be using? And not stop with the pawing around with the bad metrics. Let's figure the damn thing out. So there's my little speech halfway through or three quarters of the way through the show here now, Yash. But it's sad to say in 2024, 100 years of electric light, and we still don't know, or 150 years of electric light, and nobody knows how to do it in the exterior environment correctly. That's sad.
So I have a sort of follow-up question for you, which I saw a talk by a lighting engineer in Boston at one of these IDA meetings, and she mentioned that smart lights have been around for the last maybe 5 to 10 years. I forget the exact number, but like intelligent lighting is something that we now have technological access to that we haven't had, say, for 90 years of lighting. history, or the exact numbers I might be getting wrong. But if we have access to that, even things like turning off lights because of time, with motion sensors, with just say, if we can't agree on color, let's ignore that for now and say, can't we just have light when we need it? And why do you think that's hard for us to implement or sort of wrap our heads around collectively?
Well, the first problem is that nobody is studying, well, I don't know everything. I'm not aware of everything that's happening in the world. But what I would say is that all of the money in lighting controls, so what you're talking about is advanced connected lighting control systems, right? That that can be deployed on municipal levels or regional levels, right? On all the outdoor electric lights. Now, do we have the technology? Yes. But, you know, the first thing I would say is that way too many of our smart developers work on video games, social media, and online casinos. It's funny, but it's sad. I mean, how many of our greatest minds spend times thinking about how to addict people to their phones? I mean, it's sad, which is another form of light pollution, actually. You know, we have to get these people out of Silicon Valley and into lighting control systems for the exterior environment. Okay. And so very little money or time is spent on testing, trying out exterior lighting control systems. And in my opinion, Yash, that is absolutely the best business case for advanced lighting controls. You could not have a better application for advanced lighting controls than municipal environments for a ton of reasons. To study crime with light, to study homelessness with light, to study safety, perceptions of safety. If we give people control over their lights, do they turn them on or do they leave them at the dimmed level? Right? Because the safety perception is gone if someone can turn on the lights when they need them. So now all of a sudden, you know, the impacts of this cascade through climate change, energy savings, all over the place, but nobody is doing it. And I don't know the reason why. And I've been screaming from the rooftops, Yash, about this. So yes, at that IDEA meeting, whoever said that smart lighting, intelligent lighting or whatever exists, yes, but nobody in the lighting industry cares about it. In the exterior environment. Why? I don't know why. To me, I see, honestly, Yash, I see darkness restoration as the number one revenue generator for the lighting industry in the next 25 years. I don't see selling more light fixtures. I see us changing our mindset. You want to talk about a paradigm shift? People throw around the word paradigm shift all the time. I got a paradigm shift for the lighting industry, Yash. We supply lighting and darkness, both. That is the job of the lighting and darkness industry. No more lighting industry, lighting and darkness industry. And so that's where we have to go. And until the lighting industry embraces that and finds a way to sell that to its customers through lighting control systems, right? They already have the apps. You could make an Uber easily, if you had a lighting control system in a town, you could connect to birdfly.org. It's out there. I don't know what it's called. And batfly.org. And you would know when those animals are coming over the horizon and you could change your lighting or turn off your lighting to accommodate them. You could make an Uber for light pollution. I'm telling you, it's all, everything exists. The only thing standing in the way is the lighting industry, Ash. I get so angry about this. But the only thing standing in the way is the lighting industry. Yep.
Hey, Michael, can I shift topics a little bit?
Anything, just, man. Get me out of this place. I'm so frustrated by this.
All right. So I have one of my questions I have. Yash, you have a website. I think it's called Moz of India. Is that right?
Yeah.
So I just took a quick look at it. Did you start that? And how does that work? And it looks pretty cool. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So yeah, thanks for bringing that up. So yeah, maybe a little bit of where I started is necessary to get into why we started that website. But when I started looking at moths in India, maybe about 10 years ago, 10, 15 years ago, there was nothing outside of what the Britishers had published 50 years ago about moths and insects. So we had these like really detailed volumes, about 10,000 species they'd found across India. And then for 50 years, 50, 60 years after independence, there was like a vacuum when it came to biodiversity monitoring of moths. People studying pest moths had done a great job. They'd like looked at life history, they looked at everything about it, but it was in anything that ate plants and was a pest. For everything else, it ignored. So when I reached, I was like saying, why? I can't even find images of these moths. I just have these old text dusty volumes. So this was sort of people in butterflies had come across this, but there'd been field guides, there'd been a lot of like natural history guides for butterflies as I started. So I was like, okay, we need more pictures, we need more information about moths. If I go set up a moth light, moth screen, and these insects come to it, we need to be able to identify it. And there was the person who was doing this for butterflies sort of encouraged us and pushed me and a few other scientists and people who were sort of not even, we were like amateur citizen scientists at that point, to sort of do this. And we basically used, it was a developer from UK who was an Indian, a few other people came together and said, we're just going to start making a citizen science platform for people to upload images of moths they've seen. And rather than just having an upload, we'll work really hard with other people who identify moths and make sort of a database of species that we can go and look at and say, oh, that's this moth. And yeah, it's been about 2014 is when we started it. So it's been about 10 years and we're at about, we're inching our way to 3,000 species and about 30,000 observations. So it's a, wow. Now I use it to just go look at which moth I've seen because I can't keep track of all 10,000, but at least we have the images. But it's been a really amazing initiative because now we can go ask questions like which moths are common in a city, which moths are common in your backyard, because, and then I can say, okay, if we implement these lighting solutions, what happens to the common moths? What happens to these 100 moths you see in every city across India, if there are any?
Can we use moths as a signal species?
Definitely. I mean, one of my big pitches has been people have been studying fruit flies as a model for lab studies and then other insects like dragonflies as bioindicators or mayflies. But I would say moths are, if you go out and set out a moth screen, you get maybe 10 moths and one of every other insect. Just look at ratios. So in terms of just biomass, in terms of flying at night, moths are a huge sort of signal for what's happening out there. So when I started doing urban moth studies, I would go and see 3 moth species. When I went to a forest 10 minutes away, I'd get 200. So just moth abundance is actually a really good signal of how much light pollution is in that area. What's happening, both from a habitat point of view, because moths are tied to the plants. And unlike butterflies, which are sometimes tied to very specific plants, a lot of moths are generalist. They'll go feed on a lot of plants in that area. So they're also giving you a signal of how good the habitat is. So I think moths are really, like monitoring moths is a good way to just monitor what's happening with light pollution at night, because they're the most affected animal. And it's not hard to like trap them.
So forget about bats, turtles. We're done with you. We're going moths. The moth should be the symbol of the darkness restoration and night preservation movement. You know, people, what is it? You know, humans are so funny. We care way more about butterflies than moths. Like way more. Like it's not even a comparison. Like my kids love butterflies, but I hate moths.
Yeah, I mean, I think I felt that way too for the longest time. So I relate because I was an amateur butterfly watcher and we'd go collecting butterflies, just catching them and photographing them all across India. And it was like this like Pokemon game almost, right? Like you got to go and photograph the new rare butterfly that you haven't seen. You got to photograph them all. And I think till I had websites for moths so people could do the same thing, where set up a moth screen in your backyard and go and identify a species and give it a name and say, I've not seen this before. Till you could say, have I caught it or not? It was very hard to sort of connect to any animal. And I think the same things happen for beetles, for dragonflies. That if you can go and sort of put a stamp on it and say, I know what this is, then people start getting into the natural history, the biology. But without being able to say, I know what something is, we have no connection with it, right? Then it's just another moth. Because a lot of times, color-wise, brightness-wise, anyone I've ever taken to a moth screen comes back saying, oh my God, I thought these moths were so boring, but they're so cool. And that was my first experience at a moth screen. So I think a lot of that is exposure. And if you see it once, you're like, this is so cool. It's kind of, I don't have to, it's actually better for people because you can sit in your backyard, you can drink a beer or so. All the moths come to you. You don't have to go chase them. So it's an easier... UK is sort of very into social mothing, unlike butterfly hunting, where sometimes everyone's off in different places. So I think it's a culture mindset, and once people do it, they sort of enjoy it a lot.
So you know what you're saying, you're pointing at human nature to help us solve our problems. You know, if we harness these status games, right? So you play a game with people where the top person gets honor and status from knowing or collecting more moths, or from being willing to fly a plane into a aircraft carrier. Humans start doing all sorts of crazy things to get status. It's very strange to, when you actually step back and you say, all, you know, kamikazes, suicide bombers, all these people, what they're not crazy. They're just playing a status game. And we need to start harnessing these status games. Like I've said to you before, Mark, we have to make darkness restoration and night preservation the cool thing in the lighting industry. As soon as it becomes all the cool kids are doing dark sky lighting now, everyone will want to do it because we all, at the end of the day, crave status. We want to be the highest status in our little butterfly chasing group in India, or, you know, in the soft lights a foundation status game, you know, or the nailed organization. We have to begin to harness these status games and playing them in order and creating them in order to get the results we want to, you know, for the environment, for the moths. Let me ask you something. If moths are the signal species, if we were able to fund a specific study, would you be able to discover the right light that we should use color-wise? We know we need to shield it. We know when you want to turn it off. We know all that stuff. Yash, we don't need study. But would you be able to tell us what nanometers of light is best for nocturnal animals using moths?
Yeah, I think they've actually done that study. Like, it got published last year. They looked at like 10 different light conditions and they asked what a moth sees. So I think the answer in terms of most insect, like 90% of the insects, it's pretty clear amber, red lights are better than white and blue lights. Fireflies are the exception because they use yellow lights to signal, right? They're doing it for very different things. So I would say fireflies and moth, like animals that emit light, are like one exception. But generally, we have a decent sense that blue and white light is bad. But yes, if you gave us more money, we could actually go out and test this and like 4 field sites in India, in Central America, in the Northeast. And we're actually trying to do something like this through a NSF project, which is like get scientists from across the world. So one of the issues we've had is everyone does this in their silos. I do it in my lab. Someone does it in Miami. Someone does it somewhere else. And we don't talk to each other till we publish the study a year later. So what we're now trying to do is get all these scientists who have the equipment, who have the resources to go test this, but all of us do it together in different places and sort of then collectively look at our data. And we think that's what we need to start putting in money towards, which is not just everyone doing it on their own, but sort of doing a group, we call it a distributed experiment, which we all do it simultaneously. I mean, there's a really cool example of people, astronomers who wanted to measure the, I think, time of rotation of the Earth, sent like astronomers all over the planet at the same time to look at that one event. And I think that's what we need, which is we just need to all work together and get this data in different places and then see what it's telling us.
Whew. Can you believe we spoke for 45 minutes? Crazy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it just flew by. You know, before we close out, I'm going to go over to Mark to see. I don't want to cut you off if you have another question for Yash. He's here now. If you got one more, ask him, and then we'll go from some final thoughts for Nash, for Yash.
Oh, well, I mean, we could go for a long time. In my mind, is my experiences, it's been a long time now, but my experience walking around an observatory, they use this close to red color. And they keep it very dim. So you let your eyes adjust and then you can still walk around. Everything's still fine. So there's this idea of letting your eyes adjust. We don't have a society that's like that. You want to walk out immediately and be able to see And for some people, they feel safer with the blue white light, even if they're not, but they think they are. So there would be this goal of reducing the intensity, reducing it down to red. And I think when we were talking about this study that, you know, if you had a study with a goal, which is what are the quality metrics of light that would be best? Mm-hmm. And not just for humans, not just for adults, right? But for children, for the elderly, for the insects, for dogs, for bats, whatever. What is, and that's what's missing. Michael and I have talked about this before. Luminous efficacy is not everything, okay, for light. There's more to it. What about the quality metrics? So if you had a study that was titled something, what are the quality metrics that would be the best for everybody? I don't know, maybe that's too big of a study, but that's something I'd like to see.
So Yash, it's over to you for final thoughts here before we close out.
I'd say, yeah, just thank you for having me. This was a really engaging discussion, and it's I think we as scientists, we have to sort of reach across the aisle and work with people in the lighting industry and sort of get at this together, because they're advocates in every part, but we all just sit in our own silos. Mm. So I think the study has been a great opportunity for me to meet and talk to people from all across different streams. And sometimes doing cool science gets you to advocacy. So it's as someone who comes from a conservation background, it's nice to be able to have these avenues to talk to people. Thank you for inviting me. I'll sort of end with that.
And while you're at it, folks, that now that Yash has finished his final thoughts, you can go to @MothYash on X or Twitter, whatever it's Twitter. It used to be called Twitter, now it's called X. Or Instagram, you can go to Nocturne_Mariposa. And Yash Sondhi is a great, yashsondhi.com, that's YASHSONDHI.com, is a great resource. I've just been cruising it while I've been listening to Mark and Yash and having this conversation, and we would thank him for coming on. If you want to support this work, restoringdarkness.com. Check it out. Click the donate link, and you can donate towards this foundation, which is going to do great work. We just started this year, and so we're just gaining momentum. We already have one monthly donor. Why don't you become the second one? You listening to this right now. And of course, don't forget about softlights.org. Mark Baker's the executive director. I keep forgetting what your title is, Mark, but I don't think it matters.
I go by president. That's fine.
President. Softlights.org. Check out his website and his work there. And of course, like, share, join the stuff. Follow us on social media as well, the Restoring Darkness. There's a great news article link on LinkedIn. If you go to Restoring Darkness on LinkedIn, you'll find a great news link for articles about we screws the entire internet every day for articles about darkness restoration, light preservation, how animals react. So everything that is in the English language news that comes out in a newspaper or in a study goes on to the restoringdarkness.com LinkedIn page. So check that out as well. Thank you for listening, and bye for now.